Tonight on Banfield, the mystery men behind the curtain, shadowy billionaires pumping billions in dark money into American elections. Do American voters still decide who actually wins? Or are the billionaire puppeteers pulling all the strings? And later, we count on them every time a race is close, and even when they're not. Political polls, they are the lifeblood of the horse race. But can we really trust what they say? And how do they get their results anyway? The secrets pollsters don't want you to know about, and why they just keep making money. Plus, he swore he didn't do it, but now he's changed his mind. The 16-year-old caught after a school shooting in Michigan pleads guilty to every charge against him. But what about his parents? The ones who became fugitives within days? We'll tell you what they're still facing. And then, not so fast with that royal flush. Tonight we are blowing the lid off the $1.7 million public potty in San Francisco. It turns out there's a party pooper that's coming after this plan. And white sheets unfurl in LA with a whole new brand of public hate, saying Kanye West was right about this.
The thing about it, me and Adidas, is like, I could literally say anti-Semitic and they can't drop me.
Cue the internet, the influencers, the agents, and the brands all cutting ties with Ye. And yet, silence from Adidas. How long will it take them to kick Kanye to the curb? And what about their ugly Nazi history? It's all ahead on Banfield. Hello and welcome to this Monday version of Banfield. Who really decides the winner in an American election? Is it all about one person, one vote in this country? Or do some people have a much heavier hand when it comes to pushing the result one way or the other? Like most things in politics, for the answer, you have to follow the money. But what if both candidates in a race are equally well-funded? That is the scenario playing out in Pennsylvania tonight. The Senate candidates there, John Fetterman and Mehmet Oz, have gone out of their way to attract working class voters, and they have spent millions and millions of dollars doing it. Fetterman's campaign has spent $33 million alone on TV ads, while Oz's campaign has dropped $45 million. The ads cover crime and abortion and taxes and Social Security, but the biggest message is our guy understands blue-collar voters better than the other guy. This despite the fact that both of these candidates come from a hell of a lot of money. I'm joined by News Nation senior national correspondent Brian Enten, who is live in Pennsylvania tonight. Brian, things are really ramping up in that state, especially with the big debate tomorrow night between these two, and the gap has certainly narrowed.
Oh, it certainly has, Ashley. I can't believe it. I was standing here a month ago, and Fetterman was up by 10 percentage points in most of the polls. A massive gap, double digits. Tonight, on the eve of this debate, they are essentially tied when you average a lot of these polls. They're each at about 45% tonight, neck and neck, which is why everybody's going to be watching this debate tomorrow.
So what's interesting is if people have been watching the ads, and even if you're not in Pennsylvania, you've been seeing the coverage of the ads because these two have been, you know, going at it. And a lot of it's been online, too. Some very clever online advertising. Oz has really gone after Fetterman for being from a rich family and yet wearing the hoodie to be a man of the people. But at the same time, you know, Oz calls himself the man of the people. He's a TV star with millions and millions of dollars in his bank account, and he's backed by the guy who's like the quintessential rich kid who did well in politics, Donald Trump.
Yeah, the Trump war chest, Ashley, that's what this is being called. MAGA Inc. That is Trump's PAC that is funding a lot of the Republicans in these battleground states, including Dr. Oz. The Trump PAC pumped about $7 million recently into a number of these states. A lot of that money went to Dr. Oz. Dr. Oz was running low on money over the last month. He had to give his own campaign about $1 million to keep those campaign ads flowing. Fetterman, you mentioned it. He sort of portrays himself as the everyday guy that can relate to the people. Big money behind him, too. Yes, he's getting a lot of the smaller donations, but big PACs from around the country are pumping money into the Fetterman campaign. And you said it, Oz has gone after him. He says he can relate to everyone and low-income people, but he grew up rich. There's no way around it. He grew up in a rich suburb here. His parents gave him money up until he was in his 40s. He got like over $50,000 just one year from his parents in 2015. And he went to Harvard, no student loan debt. So when you talk to people on the streets, the voters here, which we have been for the last several days, they say with both of the candidates, they're kind of over both of them trying to portray themselves as, you know, regular people. Dr. Oz, clearly rich TV doctor. Fetterman does come from, you know, a high class background.
So funny how they craft their campaign messages, though, in those ads, right? So tomorrow, all eyes are going to be on this debate because, you know, two debates in this country have really, you know, generated a lot of fire. And that is this one, which is tomorrow night in Pennsylvania. And also, you know, the one that we had here on News Nation from Georgia, Senator Raphael Warnock against Herschel Walker. Tell me a little bit about what the biggest headlines are going into this debate tomorrow night, Brian.
Look, I think, sadly, the biggest headline here, at least when we talk to voters, what they're going to be looking out for is Fetterman's health. I mean, we know that he suffered from the stroke. He's been recovering. His doctor says he's doing better, but he still has issues understanding and internalizing words that he hears. So there's going to be this closed captioning system that is used tomorrow at the debate, Ashley. So basically everything that the moderator says, everything that Dr. Oz says will be on a big screen, almost like a teleprompter, and there will be closed captioners working there in real time, quickly typing everything out so that Fetterman can read it in real time. The voters here say that they want to watch this go down for themselves. They've seen the campaign ads. They've heard Dr. Oz attack Fetterman's condition. They want to see how he does for themselves tomorrow night.
I think that's what a lot of people across the country want to see as well. Brian, thank you. I just want to remind our viewers, this is tomorrow night here on News Nation. It's our exclusive debate, and it gets underway at 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 o'clock Central for anybody who wants to tune into the fireworks. Not only do we have a lot of pregame warm-up that sets the stage for this debate, but also the postgame wrap-up with Chris Cuomo. So there's going to be some great stuff. My colleague Leland Fittert's going to be helming that production as well. Make sure you tune in right here. We'll have some wrap up at 10 o'clock as well. Brian Enten, thank you for that. So the candidate's personal wealth that Brian was talking about, it is not the only money that comes into play. There's also something called dark money. And if you've heard of it but don't know a lot about it, you're in luck. It's called dark money because it is raised by secret donors who stay in the shadows, and it is meant to specifically influence elections. And it might sound like some kind of a conspiracy theory, but it's not. It is real. And it is hard at work right this minute deciding which party controls Congress after this year's midterms. More than $1.6 billion has been spent on TV ads in a dozen Senate races. And you guessed it, most of that money is coming from dark money sources, groups and people that we really just know nothing about. Three out of every $4 of that money is being spent in just six states: Georgia, Pennsylvania, Arizona, Wisconsin, Nevada, and Ohio. And yes, you guessed it. Those are the states with highly competitive races that both sides need to win if they hope to control the House and the Senate. And we are talking, folks, about gajillions of dollars here. I want to break down a couple of states for you. I'm going to start in Georgia. $258 million has been spent on TV ads just for these midterms in Georgia. And it breaks down in a pretty suspicious way. On the Democratic side, the candidates have spent over $77 million, but nearly $64 million more has come from the dark money side. On the Republican side of the waiver here, it is even more eye-popping. The candidates have spent just over $16 million, with an additional $100 million coming from the dark money coffers. And again, all of that, just Georgia. So let's move on to the state with the second biggest spending. We were just there, Pennsylvania, with Brian Enten. So in that state, $241 million has been spent on TV ads, and it breaks down like this. On the Democratic side, candidates have spent almost $33 million, but almost $68 million extra has come from the dark money. On the Republican side, the candidates have spent almost $45 million, with almost $96 million more coming from the dark money coffers. And really, honestly, it is a similar breakdown as you go into each and every one of the other states, too. And again, it is both Republicans and Democrats that are doing this. Of all the money spent on pro-GOP ads, 86% is dark money. And of all the money spent on pro-Democratic ads, 55% is dark money. No matter what side is picking up the tab, it works out to more than $1 billion being spent by anonymous sources to influence us, the voters, and to elect the candidates. And here is the strangest part of all of this. It is completely legal. Back in 2010, you'll remember the Supreme Court ruled in a case called Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission. And in that case, the court ruled that our free speech in America prohibits the government from restricting political donations from corporations and other outside groups. Those corporations and groups still are not allowed to formally be in cahoots with the candidates or the political parties. So instead, they just set up super PACs, which allow the wealthy donors and the shadowy nonprofits to give millions and millions and millions to the campaigns without ever having to divulge who they are or what they want for their money. People, the effect of this was immediate. Just take a look at these numbers. In 2006, dark money donations were less than $5 million. So 6 years later, during the 2012 election cycle, dark money was more than $300 million. And now, in the 2022 midterms, 10 years later, it is expected to be in the billions. So our TV isn't big or tall enough to make the graph. It just kind of goes all the way up. And even though it's really tough to find out who's writing all those big, fat, sexy, dark checks, we do, in fact, know a few of them. And all of this week, we're going to roll them out for you so that you're going to know them too. Tonight, we're focusing on two of the billionaires deeply entwined in our politics, liberal donor George Soros on the left, and conservative Peter Thiel on the right. Together, they have sunk billions into United States politics. George Soros is a 92-year-old hedge fund manager worth $6.7 billion. His Open Society Foundation is the second largest philanthropy budget in the United States, just after the Bill and Melinda Gates Fund. Soros directs billions to Democratic candidates and their causes. He's been so effective that he's become something of a boogeyman for the conservatives. Entire conspiracy theories have been constructed all around him. Most of them have been proven false, and many of them anti-Semitic. And the GOP regularly fundraises against him. But on the Republican side is 55-year-old Peter Thiel. He is an entrepreneur and a venture capitalist who founded PayPal. So I guess it's no surprise that he's worth $4.3 billion. He's donated hundreds of millions of dollars to Republican and Libertarian candidates over the years, including Donald Trump. And Donald Trump named him to his transition team when he was elected president. Thiel is probably most famous as the guy who single-handedly brought down the gossip website Gawker by paying for Hulk Hogan's lawyers and others who sued the site. And since then, Thiel has increased his political donations and is now one of the largest donors to Republican candidates, even though he is seeking citizenship in Malta. But what's to be made of these political boogeymen and all their dark money? Are these billionaires just exercising their First Amendment freedom of speech? Or are they gaming our system and swaying our elections? And by the way, is our $20 donation just a total waste of time and money now? It's a good question. It's get some answers. I'm joined by Kurt Anderson. He's a journalist and the author of Evil Geniuses, The Unmaking of America, A Recent History. Joel Kotkin is an expert on global, economic, political, and social trends. His book is called The Coming of Neo-Feudalism, A Warning to the Global Middle Class. And Kenneth Vogel is a New York Times columnist. His book is called Big Money, $2.5 Billion, One Suspicious Vehicle, and a Pimp on the Trail of the Ultra-Rich Hijacking American Politics. Okay, welcome to all three of you. I have so many questions, and I'm so happy that the three of you are here because you're really all experts on this. Kurt, I'm going to begin with you. Did the billionaires and the corporations really, you know, flower and proliferate after Citizens United? I mean, the numbers certainly look like it, but I feel like I've been watching, you know, lots of dirty money in politics for a long time.
You have. And indeed, one of the histories that I trace in Evil Geniuses is exactly that, that it was really starting in the 1970s and 80s because of various regulatory changes then and the rise of the rich and big business deciding that they needed to get into politics and electoral politics in a bigger way. That's when you saw this overnight, this gigantic increase in PACs. PACs were created. Now, there are super PACs subsequently, but that's when this really began, before and after 1980. And also when the tilt of who was giving this big money in this arms race, if you will, of political donation shifted from the trade unions, labor unions, as it had been mostly, more than half of those big donations had been them. And then by the 1980s, it was overwhelmingly big business. So that's what you saw. And then it kept rising and rising over the next couple of decades. And what Citizens United did was essentially make meaningful campaign reform and campaign finance controls unconstitutional because it equated for the first time explicitly free speech with money. So there could be no meaningful controls or restraint on corporations and rich individuals' gigantic donations. And so therefore, somebody like Peter Thiel can give $10, $15, $20 million to his candidates in Arizona and Ohio, J.D. Vance and Blake Masters.
So Joel, I want you to jump in with the idea that it isn't just the money. I mean, yes, they've got incredibly deep pockets, but they also, many of them, are in control of the tech sector. And so they have a lot of information on us as well. And knowledge is power, and so is money. And the two of them together are like combustible. So what are we supposed to think about, you know, our actual power in elections going forward?
Well, the first thing that's really interesting is that as I've traced this over the years, particularly in the tech sector is overwhelmingly Democratic. That's here in California where I live. They are one of the biggest contributors. For instance, Gavin Newsom gets a lot of money from them. There is a slight movement of more towards the Republicans. I think a lot of big business and tech people are upset with where the administration's going. But to me, the real problem is not the politics of the rich themselves. It's the fact that we have become such a unequal society, such a, if you will, neo-feudal society, that in a way, these are like sort of aristocratic lords who, you know, battle each other, you know, like in the Middle Ages or in Japan with the daimyo. And that's really, to me, the great danger is not what these people believe. It's not whether they're right or left. It's that they exist and have so much power and so much money. Look, you know, you might say, well, the Republicans are getting, you know, this amount of money. But, you know, when you have essentially, for instance, Jeff Bezos owning the Washington Post, well, you know, how much is that worth relative to a campaign contribution? I mean, one of the scary things to me is the movement of the tech oligarchs into mass media, which is in many ways an even more pervasive problem. But the big problem is concentration of wealth and power in a few hands, and, you know, frankly, the both parties
very powerful hands.
Like very, very powerful hands. But that's a very good point. There's the dark money and then there's the bright light money that's, you know, pumping out papers and you know, TV channels and radio stations and blogs and all the rest. So, Kenneth, jump in here about the names that we don't know. I've just named two pretty famous guys. Lots of people could look up Peter Thiel and George Soros and know a lot about them. And maybe they won't feel it so dark because they know who they are and what they're all about. How many people don't we know about and how many are they and how much are they giving?
Well, we don't know what we don't know. And if there are sophisticated lawyers and operatives who are on both the donor side as well as the group side, the sort of dark money nonprofit groups that collect and spend this money, we'll never know. There are some that are slightly more transparent. Actually, George Soros is among them. He voluntarily discloses in somewhat close to real time, not just the amount of money that his foundations are giving to groups that are active in political ventures, but also how much he's giving personally in dark money, which sort of makes it not so dark. But there are whole collections of donors, and there are coalitions of donors who are constantly being cultivated by these operatives to give more money. Sometimes they actually meet in, you know, at convenings, semi-annual or annual convenings. This was something that the Koch brothers, the billionaire industrialist from Kansas, kind of started. But there's also a group on the left that George Soros is among the leaders of, called the Democracy Alliance. And so how do we find out who the folks are who are giving through these coalitions? Well, one way is to actually find out where the meetings are. They're usually kept a very closely held secret. But for reporters who follow this type of stuff, you work the operatives who are on the fundraising side or the spending side, the cutting the ads, and try to figure out where the coalitions are and literally go and stake them out in the bars or the hotel lobby to try to see who's coming and going. And that really, unfortunately, is one of the few ways that we in the media and therefore the public can find out about who these folks are.
So, Kurt, I have like 20 seconds left, but I do want to get this question. As actually, I have so many questions, but I just have time for this last one. And that is, if there were no dark money at all, who gets the advantage?
Well, I think maybe the way to frame that question is not if there's no dark money, because darkness, again, isn't the only problem. The problem is the size of the amounts of money that these corporations and billionaires are allowed to spend. If gigantic contributions were once again banned in this country and it was all relatively small donations, it would probably be about equal. Nobody would have a significant financial advantage because Republicans and Democrats alike would get small donations according to their candidates.
So that $20 donation that we all want, you know, want to give every so often, it would actually count. You all have to come back again because I have 20 more questions and zero more time. So Kurt Anderson, Joel Kotkin, and Kenneth Vogel, thank you so much. Look forward to our next conversation.
Thank you.
Coming up next, with control of the House and the Senate up for grabs, all eyes are on the polls. But are they still as broken today as they were back in 2016 when nobody saw the Trump upset coming? And could Trump somehow throw the numbers this midterm season? We're digging in and finding out the magic and the science, or lack thereof, in the polls. Sometimes politics can feel more like a sport than a science. And if you're betting on who will win this November, counting on the polls might let you down. And there is perhaps no better reminder of that than Trump's surprise win on election night 2016. Before that night, the polls consistently projected Hillary Clinton had a lock on the presidency and that she'd undoubtedly trounce Donald Trump. The forecasts were actually 70% to 99% that she was going to take that race. And most polls projected that Clinton would win important states like Pennsylvania, which in the end went to Trump. The forecasts were actually 70 to 99% that, oh, I already mentioned that. Sorry, we'll go over that again. We don't need that. But the deal is that a lot of people were shocked when the result was the way it was. And afterwards, there was a major come to Jesus moment for pollsters and a total cleanup of the egg all over their face. So what did they miss? It was the $64,000 question back then. And one thing they realized was that they ignored the non-college educated voter who heavily favored Donald Trump. Adjustment made, problem solved. right? Wrong. 4 years later, the polls leading up to the 2020 presidential race were actually the least accurate polls in 40 years. And statewide polls were the least predictive in at least 20 years. So this isn't me calling out the polls. They have their own dang association, appropriately named the American Association for Public Opinion Research. And they know that the system is broken. They just haven't quite figured out exactly why or, you know, what's the thorn in the side. One theory, though, is that Trump repeatedly told his followers to ignore the polls. He called them fake. And he said that polls were meant to suppress the enthusiasm for right-wing candidates. So is it possible that Trump voters were less likely to answer the pollsters' questions when they came calling? Maybe. Of course, Trump's not on the ballot in these midterm elections, but he is certainly out on the campaign trail. He's also in the news daily because of a handful of criminal investigations and legal cases that have yet to be decided. But will the Trump effect skew the numbers again? Or worse, is there something else affecting the polls that we may not even be aware of yet? Joining me now is Sherry Jacobus. She's the host of Politics with Sherry Jacobus. And Miles Coleman is the associate editor of Sabatow's Crystal Ball, which is the election handicapper from UVA's Center for Politics. Welcome to you both. It's great to have you. Miles, I'll begin with you. Why is it so unreliable? It seems like it, by this point in life and all the technical, you know, assistance that we have, we should have it down to a pretty good science, but we don't.
You would think, yeah, it's really after 2016, one of those big takeaways was, well, you know, if you're a pollster, you just have to wait for education. Well, a lot of pollsters tried to make adjustments, and it didn't happen in 2020. They were still pretty far off the mark. I think for pollsters, maybe the bad news is, you know, it's a tough time to be in the industry. Maybe one of the pieces of good news is, well, it's a good time for innovation. You know, there really is no easy answer. One thing I will say is that the sentiment I get from talking with pollsters is they can't expect pollsters to be, you know, right 100% of the time or everything. You know, one stat that you mentioned in your intro, Nate Silver was saying that Hillary Clinton had a 70% chance of winning the presidency in 2016. Well, she has a 30% chance of losing. That's not a lot, but it's not nothing either. So I think the public really struggles with these concepts of nuance and probability. But yeah, sure. It is. You know, it's a tough time to be in the industry.
Sherry, let me ask you this. You know, I remember when cell phones started coming online, we started to realize, hey, you're calling all these landlines, but you're not getting people like me who ditched my landline, and I should be represented in these polls. And we've accommodated for that. We now have a lot of cell phone use. We have a lot of online polling. We even have something called interactive voice response. But I have got to ask you, what kind of people sit for these robo voices that poll them? Are they actually representative of the rest of the country?
Well, I think you just laid out the problem. There are so many different ways to poll people that it makes it almost impossible for these to be consistent or to be able to compare the various polls accurately. By the way, in 2016, when the polls did tighten at the end, and it did say that Hillary Clinton would win the popular vote by the amount that she, in fact, won by. And it was only later in the evening that we found out that Trump was able to pull out a win in those key states. So, you know, the national polls, maybe it's easier to poll, as you noted, it's harder in the states. But yeah, I don't think that Donald Trump is out there telling his people don't answer polls, because when there's polls they like to talk about them. They want to take part in those. So I don't think he's really having that kind of an impact in that regard. I think it's just tougher all the way around. And then we know this is a turnout election like anything else. It's so close that when you've got some polls that have somebody pulling 1 point ahead, and then the next day it looks like they're 1 point behind. It's just, I mean, this is going to be a turnout election. There aren't that many people whose minds you can change. You just have to get them to the polls. And that's, of course, the challenge for each campaign.
So, Miles, I got 30 seconds left. We've got lots of caller ID, and we've got lots of spam blockers, and they get better and better. Is that skewing things? Because, you know, you can't talk to most people in this country if they don't want to be talked to.
Yeah, I mean, I would say so. And even with those methods, you know, one thing I've noticed is getting more popular is polling by text. Well, I could get a text as a person living in Virginia to take a poll in the Las Vegas area. So I think some pollsters, you know, need to really, you know, do a better job of targeting their audience. But at the same time, it's hard because just no one picks up the phone. We have call screeners. So it's people are just generally less willing. So that leads to all kinds of creative weighing and sampling on the side of the pollsters.
Yeah, I'm fascinated to find out how the polls, you know, are affected by the debates, because the big one, you know, tomorrow night, Oz Fetterman, right here on News Nation, did I mention? 7-6 Central. I'm always interested to see if there's the spike or if it really affects things or if it's just, you know, anybody's guess. Miles Coleman and Sherry Jacobus, thank you both. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
At just 16 years old, he was locked up and facing 24 charges, including 4 counts of murder. And what did his parents do? They fled for the Canadian border when they heard the police were after them, too. Today, their teenager admitted he was guilty in court. So are the fugitive parents doing that too? You'll find out next. Couple of updates now to some important stories that we've been telling you about. And I'm going to start in Michigan with that 16-year-old boy who was arrested after the school shooting last year that killed 4 kids and wounded 7 others. Do you remember this teenager? Whose parents were also wanted by the police, but they took off for the Canadian border and became fugitives while their child was locked up behind, alone at the jail. Eventually, they were caught and they were locked up in the same jail as their son. Today, that teenager, Ethan Crumbly, pled guilty to all of the 24 charges against him, including terrorism and murder. And here he was in court sealing his own fate.
Is it true that your actions on November the 30th, 2021 caused the deaths of Madison Baldwin, Tamir, Anna St. Juliana, and Justin Schilling?
Yes.
But Crumbly's case wasn't the only order of business that played out today. Here is the Oakland County prosecutor, Karen McDonald.
The individual who committed the shootings at Oxford High School pled guilty to all charges this morning, including terrorism. I've just come from meeting with the victims who were in court today. This is the first time they've heard the shooter, in his own words, detail how he obtained the weapon.
And that's key, because Crumbly stated on the record today that he got that deadly 9mm semi-automatic handgun from an unlocked container in the home that he shared with his parents, which is not good news for his mom and dad, Jennifer and James Crumbly. They are charged with involuntary manslaughter for making that gun available to their son. They bought it just 4 days before the killings. But unlike their son, Ethan, Jennifer and James Crumbly have pleaded not guilty. And their trial is still ahead. It is slated for January. Going to take you to New York now, where a former police commissioner is breaking the blue wall of silence. And he is ripping into a former police captain in the Big Apple. That captain is now Mayor Eric Adams. And the former commissioner, Ray Kelly, was not holding back when he was asked during a radio interview about the rising crime problem in New York.
As I've often said, we were the safest big city in America just a few years ago. So this is not brain surgery. You go back and look at the things we were doing then, and you re-implement them. But apparently the mayor doesn't want to do this, doesn't want to put back in anti-crime units, doesn't want to use the stop and frisk in a natural, normal way.
Okay, that's key, that stop and frisk business, because stop and frisk was the controversial practice involving police officers stopping and searching millions of New Yorkers based on, quote, reasonable suspicion. The majority of the people stopped, though, were Black or Hispanic people, and weapons were rarely found. And after stop and frisk was abandoned, the crime levels actually continued to go down in the city. And that prompted the former mayor, Michael Bloomberg, to ultimately apologize for that practice. Finally, now I want to take you to New Hampshire tonight, where a 32-year-old father has been charged with second-degree murder after this little 5-year-old girl, his daughter, Harmony Montgomery, vanished without a trace. Her dad, Adam Montgomery, had been under investigation for months upon months because even though no one had seen Little Harmony since 2019, she wasn't reported missing until 2021. Montgomery is also accused of repeatedly striking her in the head with a closed fist back in 2019. But at this point, police have not yet said whether they have found Harmony's body. We'll continue to update you on that case. Coming up, San Francisco politicians get a scolding from their governor over spending. Number one, nobody likes paying taxes. And nobody likes spending money on number two. So the Parks and Rec Department, they're getting dumped on over plans to build a $1.7 million toilet. Will this crappy idea end up going down the drain? We've got the update next. I've got an update for you on the story that we brought you on Thursday about that public works project in San Francisco that frankly isn't working. You might actually say it's suddenly backed up. City leaders in San Francisco had the bright idea to build a modern public toilet in a neighborhood that was struggling with homelessness and public pooping. And design they did. They came up with a single toilet that would take 3 whole years to build and cost the taxpayers an estimated $1.7 million. But when the governor of California got wind of the cost of the project, he blew his lid. Here is a statement from Gavin Newsom's office. Quote, "A single small bathroom should not cost $1.7 million. The state will hold funding until San Francisco delivers a plan to use this public money more efficiently. If they cannot, we will go back to the legislature to revoke this appropriation." And by the way, for context, the average price of an entire house in the same neighborhood of San Francisco where this $1.7 million toilet was planned is just $1.3 million. And I'm sure that toilets are included. It sounds like the governor decided that the San Francisco proposal was a pile of crap. And I think many of us would agree. So coming up, since when did it become okay to roll out the white bed sheets while decrying Jews and saluting Adolf Hitler in public? Since Kanye chose to vomit anti-Semitism all over the internet.
The thing about it, me and Adidas, is like, I could literally say anti-Semitic and they can't drop me.
But now the internet is fighting back and demanding that Adidas answer that question, what next? After the break, see the long list of powerhouse forces that have sent Kanye packing and those who have not.
If you wake up thinking about the markets and want to make